This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Play the play on the show.
In this hour, we welcome Michael Bumpus into the studio. Very excited to have him here for Blue 42.
This is Coors Light's Blue 42.
We're going to go red, right, tight, close, sprint left, G, U corner, halfback, flat, on two, ready, fight!
Blue 42 is brought to you by Coors Light. The mountains turn blue at 42 degrees.
Blue 42!
Now here's your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Blue 42! Blue 42!
Good morning, Bump. How you doing, buddy?
I am awesome. How are you guys doing this lovely morning?
We are not as rich as Garrett Cole of the New York Yankees, who just got paid $11 billion, an actual number, by New York.
This is a good question right here, because they did. You got $324 million. Do you congratulate someone when they buy something? Like, do you, like, congratulations, job well done, you got that TV. Like, why are people congratulating? Like, way to go, Brian Cashman. You got the deal. You just bought something.
They could have gone to Best Buy, Danny.
No, there's no secret to this. It's not like you accomplished something that should be praised. Like, you just went out and bought something. You paid more than everybody else was. Okay, great. I don't congratulate you for that.
Yeah, I congratulate. You got something I don't have. You know, good for you. You're doing something I ain't doing it.
That sounds like they famously Pacific Northwest passive aggressive congratulations.
Congratulations on your new car. That's so awesome. Hell no.
It kind of reminds me of those Carfax commercials that they've been showing recently, where they have people that are ashamed of how much they paid for their cars. I mean, ultimately, that's what the Yankees are going to be in like 3 to 4 years. They went onto the lot and they were like, you know what? I know I can buy this car for market value, but I like it so much, I'm going to pay $100 million more for it, just because. With that in mind, Bump, we were thinking about this morning. Because Garrett Cole is now the highest paid pitcher in baseball, definitely getting a ridiculous contract, if you could make one Seahawks player the highest paid at his respective position right now, let's rule Russell Wilson out because he already is, and I suppose we rule Bobby Wagner out, right? Because he's also in that same kind of conversation. What player would you make the highest paid at his respective position across the league?
That's tough when you exclude Bobby Wagner and Russell Wilson. So I would have to go with Clowney. And not even based off the numbers, just based off of the potential. You see that he has the potential to be a game breaker, to make great plays. And his athleticism is crazy. So I would go with Clowney just to hold him down right now. I don't think he's had a great year. He's had a decent year. He's put pressure on the quarterback. He's changed his defense in a way. So I would go with Jadeveon Clowney.
Here'd be my worry, Bump, because I think that's really, really solid rationale that Clowney is an elite player and he's had huge impact plays. I worry about spending and sort of reinvesting that amount of money in a guy who's guaranteed to be a free agent if he wants, so you know you're going to be paying top shelf price. And the defense hasn't been good necessarily with him. I'd worry that you get yourself in a situation where you're paying great money for guys who have a defense that isn't even really necessarily good.
Yeah, I understand that logic, but I'm also like, who else is out there on the team that you pay? You know, I mean, Tyler Lockett has had a decent year. He's fell off the last couple of weeks, but it's like, do you pay him? Is he a blockbuster type player? Who else? I mean, Quandre has played well on the other side of the ball, but do you pay him? I think it's circumstances. In these circumstances, with this team, with these type of players, I will go with Clown.
All right, question two, Bump. You mentioned him, Tyler Lockett. How's he looking right now? Pete tried to tell us that he's 100% last week, and he's back to it, and he caught more passes this week. How does he look to your eyes?
So I watched the film. I broke him down a bit, and he looks okay. Like, during the route running, he looks fine. What concerns me is when the ball is in his hands. He doesn't look like he's trying to get yards after the catch. So as a player, I put myself in his shoes, and I'm thinking maybe his energy level isn't there. You exert so much energy running your route and breaking down and catching the football, and when he has the ball in his hands, he just doesn't look explosive right now. So that lets me know maybe his conditioning isn't the way it used to be, because when you take 2 or 3 weeks off, not take them off, but you don't get the reps and practice that you're used to getting, your body feels it. And that's what I'm seeing with him. His routes look good. He's breaking down. He looks sharp. It's just when the ball's in his hands, he's not looking for yards after the catch. So something tells me maybe his conditioning is off a little bit, so I expect a bigger game for him this week.
Where does yards after the catch rank on the Tyler Lockett tree of feats and skills?
See, he's not a big yards after the catch guy, but he will attempt to get yards after the catch. Against the Rams, he didn't attempt to get yards after catch. He would catch the ball, and he'd go straight down to the ground. Now, he's a smaller guy. You get a hand on him, he's probably going to go down. But at least you see the want to. I just didn't see the want to against the Rams.
Question number three. Rashad Penny, done for the year. We'll hopefully see him in training camp next season with the Seahawks. How big of a loss is the end of Penny's season for this offense?
I think it's a huge loss because we saw the potential for Rashad Penny. That one game where him and Carson were going back and forth, had 200 yards rushing against the Vikings, and it got guys excited. And you think of the possibilities. You see Rashad Penny, you see him doing his thing. You're like, all right, maybe go two bags. We're going to share the carries. Carson doesn't have to give 25, 30 carries a game. We can save him, save some hits. So it's big, man. It's big because prior to that, guys wanted Rashad Penny out. Trade him. Do this, do that. You got to be patient with the running back position. Any position, you got to be patient. And it's just the potential. It's like, it was a little tease. It's like he dangled the carrot in front of you. Like, this is the possibilities. And you see what he could do. And for him to go down, it's unfortunate. But it gives opportunities for guys to step up. Maybe CJ Pro size to get more carries. And I want to see the homie Homer get some more carries, man. I love that guy. He's super explosive. But it's disappointing because we saw the potential of what he can do. Could he even sustain that? We don't know. You know, it took 10 weeks for him to really show what he can do. So I don't think it changes the offense too much, but it's disappointing because he flashed and we saw the possibilities of a Rashad Penny and Chris Carson backfield.
You mentioned Travis Homer, bump. Watching him on that fake punt and how fast he was, I don't like a lot of the new generation stats that they're putting together, like this catch probability that Amazon has. Like, I don't trust that at all. Like, I don't. But the idea of clocking a guy to see how fast his top speed is in miles per hour, I'm 100% behind that. And he was the second fastest player clocked on any NFL field that weekend. Like, that excited me. Like, that kind of speed, let's see what he can do with the Rock.
Yeah, I was super excited for that guy. He played for Miami. If you know anything, I don't even know if he's from Miami or from Florida, but Florida guys are the fastest human beings in the world. And when I saw a film,
he's not talking about you, Paul. Bumpus is not talking about you.
By proxy.
He's not talking about you.
Let's go.
Definitely not talking about Paul. Paul probably can get his knees up and have a little burst. But
thank you. That's all I need.
Most guys from Florida are super fast. So when I watch this film playing in Miami, I'm like, he looks like a Miami guy. And the way he ran that football on that fake punt, it didn't step out of bounds. That was what was impressive to me. He did not step out of bounds. He wanted the contact. He's young. He's healthy. Give this guy a chance. He's a kick returner now, so maybe he'll have an opportunity to really show his speed. The homie Homer got to get in, got to get some touches.
That is Blue 42 with Michael Bumpus. We are going to give you that code word. If you missed it last hour, we're going to give it to you again. You'll go to the website, 710sports.com/win, to punch that in. Once we give that to you, you get a chance to win tickets to see the Seahawks host the Cardinals December 22nd. Plus, the winner from this morning is going to get two pregame sideline passes, which is pretty cool. With weekly deals happening all month long, you'll find something for all the 12s on your list. Shop at one of their four locations for the Seahawks Pro Shop and online, seahawks.com/pro shop. Bump, I think we need to bring you in. We need to make a decision. Philip Rivers had a celebration that is either awful or awesome, depending on your perspective. I'm kind of torn between the two of them. Let's set the stage. This is Sunday's game against the Jacksonville Jaguars. Philip Rivers is dropping back to pass. He's shoved by Unique Ngakoue, a great defensive end, defensive lineman from the Jacksonville Jaguars, who then extends a hand and helps the veteran up. Well, as that happens, his receiver is going in for a touchdown, and, well, Philip Rivers lets him hear about it.
He's got a 90-yard touchdown! 90-yard touchdown!
I see him too. You see, I ain't talking, right? Stay humble, bro.
You know he's right.
Stay humble. Stay humble, bro.
I can say 90-yard. I can be excited.
Yeah, but don't do that by my ear. Don't do it by my ear. No,
I will do it by my ear.
No.
Hey, once. What's up? I'll holler at you after the game. 17, just keep talking.
Is that awesome or is it awful?
I appreciate his enthusiasm for the game. But this man just helped you up. And then you're walking, Bob. You could have, there's All right, so a football field is like 52 yards wide.
Yep.
And you took the narrowest route by the guy who just picked you up, and you're yelling in his ear. And it's almost like he knows that he can't do anything, so he's just going to – that's like the guy who starts barking when security comes around, you know, because he knows that security's going to break everything up, so he gets louder and louder. Man, I wanted to slap the you-know-what out of Phillip Rivers in that. Like, come on, son. Come on. He just helped you up. Yes, it's a 90-yard touchdown. Walk the other way. But that's Phillip Rivers for you, though. Like, you love him and you hate him at the same time. Like, if I'm on his team and I see that clip, oh, yeah, I'm loving him right now. But if I'm on the other end, I'm like, yeah, I'll catch you after the game, just like he said. I'll see you after the game. Phillip Rivers,
Paul,
come on.
Is it awful or is it awesome?
It's so on brand for Phillip. But
no, no, that's not, you can't say like it's good for, is it awful or is it awesome? Do you like it or do you not like it?
I love it. I love it. Because he's getting under his skin in the nicest way that he possibly can. He's saying 90-yard touchdown. And as someone who comes from the Gallant family and knows what it is like to have someone purposely try to annoy you, thanks, Dad. You have someone here in Phillip Rivers using all of his dad wisdom on Yannick Ngakoue, with all those children he's had, 90-yard touchdown. I can be enthusiastic. I can be enthusiastic. And even using his own children's logic to continue to combat Yannick Ngakoue as he runs down the field.
What is with you and the nine children clause? All of a sudden, this excuse is behavior just because.
I understand Phillip Rivers because of all the kids. He's crazy.
You
he's
have
absolutely
kids?
No, but imagine having nine. Wouldn't you lose your mind? I can barely take care of a cat. I can't imagine having nine kids.
I think it's awesome, and I think the reason is because of what he says when he says, don't do that in my ear. I will do that
I will.
Your...
I will.
I'll do that right in your ear. That's exactly what I'm going to do. That might be a new little segment where he decides if something is awful or awesome. Bump, Brian Schottenheimer, who's been the Seahawks offensive coordinator, was on a podcast with Adam Schefter, and we'll get into the bigger picture questions about Seattle's offense in just a second, but I thought it was really interesting. Here's Schottenheimer talking about Russell and his level of preparation.
He puts together maybe one of the coolest things I've ever seen a player do. He puts together a scouting report, really all by himself, that covers first, second, third down, personnel, coaches, D coordinator, and he puts it together early in the week, and he gives it to the players. And when I tell you, it rivals any scouting report that we've ever done. We certainly do one as well, but it's unbelievable. I mean, he does an amazing job. There's just countless hours. So he is a perfectionist. His work ethic is top notch. He takes care of his body, and he blew me away with that.
First question, have you ever had a quarterback that's come up with notes and presented that to you about how to approach a defense?
Never. I've worked with WSU's greatest quarterback as far as Apple Cups, Alex Brink. He never did that. When I was with the Hawks, I had Matthew Hasselback and Seneca Wallace. They never did it. So for him to overextend himself to do that is great. But I also think I'm like, okay, but they have like 25 scouts upstairs that's going to do that for you. So are you wasting time doing that? Like, I get it. I get you going above and beyond and making sure you're prepared, making sure your buddies are prepared. But the same things that he's putting on paper, they got a bunch of scouts that can do that for him. So I get it. I like it. It shows that he's prepared. It shows that he cares. But it also makes me think, can he spend his time elsewhere as well?
Is he a football savant? Is he the kind of guy that sees the game differently? I think that there are a very few players in the league that do, if he can't, that's not necessarily a referendum on him or anything like that. But that is an interesting point that you raised, Bump, because is he, with his own player's perspective, seeing the things that a coach, a scout sees on film? Because I think sometimes, especially when we're someone as good as Russell Wilson, or maybe you're someone like Kobe Bryant in another sport, you think of your own abilities as being at this level where you're going to be able to overcome some things, and maybe you can't quite see your own issues that you might be having on film, or because you're like, well, okay, but I know me, and I know that that wasn't necessarily the worst play in the world.
Yeah, I think that he's a special type of guy. He does see the game differently. Guys, I feel like throughout the history of the NFL, there's not too many guys who do the things that Russell does as far as preparation, because they rely on other resources. They rely on their coaches for the scouting reports. They rely on the other scouts watching film for them to pickup tendencies and all that. But if he's taking the time to do all that, that just shows you he's super prepared. There's not going to be too much that you're going to throw at him on a Sunday that he's not prepared for. So I can appreciate it. But now as a player, say I'm a receiver, as I am a receiver, I'm also thinking, all right, which scouting report do I look at? Do I take the one that the coaches give me, or do I follow Russ's scouting report? And if there are differences in the scouting report, you know, which one do I kind of lean on, you know?
You know the answer to that. You suck up to the quarterback because he's the one that's going to throw you the ball.
Yeah, you do. But you also suck up to the coach because you want him to call the play to get you open. You know, like, yeah, there's certain plays that are called. You're like, yeah, that's my play. So, you know, I'm going to make sure I'm on point. So it's a tricky little dance.
A lot of politicking.
Yeah, it is politicking. It really is.
I'm interested in this, Paul. Who do you think is kind of a savant? Who do you think sees of the quarterbacks who see the game differently? I tend to think of quarterbacks in terms of some guys are gunslingers and other guys master systems. I don't think of quarterbacks who kind of exist outside their own scheme and are kind of like, hey, that guy on his own sees the game a little bit differently and is able to play it differently.
I think Brady is very good at knowing what the defense is doing. And he, before a snap, will figure out what they're doing with their pre-snap tells, I think, better than anyone. There's a reason he lets that play clock drip all the way to usually like 3 or 2. And I feel like by that time, he will have figured out, for the most part, sometimes a defense can fool him, what a defense is going to do. I think what separates Russ, and maybe this comes from that over-preparation, is that when a play breaks down, I think that because he knows all the things that are supposed to be happening, I feel like he maybe is a little more calm because of that, and that allows him to do some of the amazing things that he does, improvising. You can improvise all you want, but when you're preparing to improvise a little bit, I imagine that makes you a better improviser. And I think that's one of the things that really has set Russell apart in his career is that, okay, the pocket has just collapsed, but where's the best spot for me to move against this defense where I'm going to have either the ability to run potentially for a gain and throw it down the field, or where one or the other is going to just open itself up because of where I am physically moving as a quarterback. And I'm imagining that is something that maybe he takes into account while the scouts and the coaches are maybe just looking at, okay, Russ, this is what we want you to do on a play. This is how the play is drawn up. This is what we would like you to do. Because how often is he doing a play and running it exactly the way that the coaches want it to? Sometimes by nature, he just needs to do it a different way.
See, and I disagree with that because I think that once a play breaks down, it just becomes man football. You can have any – you can play against a zone. You have your play, you run your zone. All right, the defense runs their zone, you have your play, and it breaks down. Then it just becomes who's closest to me on the defensive side of the ball. Who's closest to me? Who do I pick up? So I don't think you can really prepare for a scramble drill. I think it's more off the chemistry between you and your receivers.
Can you know maybe where – there are going to be easier spots to scramble before a play starts just based off of the looks that are being given? That's my question. And I mean, maybe you can, maybe you can't. Honestly, I mean, Russell's going to know this way better than me.
I think you have an idea. You have an idea of maybe where you should go, but it's all reactive, you know? Like, say you have a too high, you're playing against a too high team. Maybe they're playing against a cover two, and you get a scramble drill. Sometimes that corner who's supposed to be in the flat will drop down to a deep fourth just because of a scramble drill and what a receiver is doing. Sometimes he'll just sit there and play the QB's eye. So I think it's more reactive. You're going off of what the defense is showing you, but knowing what the defense is doing pre-snap will help you throughout a play.
What makes Brady special in your eyes, Bumpus?
I think Paul hit on the head, just knowing what the defense is doing and his anticipation. He does not have a strong arm. He's never had the strongest arm. And guys who don't have strong arms who are successful in the NFL in any type of football can anticipate throws and can manipulate defenses. You see Brady, he gets back there, there's a little shoulder pump, and Breeze is great at it too. He moves the defense with a shoulder pump with his eyes. So it's just anticipation and knowing what the defense is trying to take away and going the opposite way, and I think Brady is awesome at it. And then checking out of plays as well. When a coordinator calls a play and a quarterback lines up and looks at the defense, that's not going to work. I'm going to check out and get us in a better situation. I think Brady does a great job of that.
How about Wilson? Because we've seen him, and this is his second year with Schottenheimer, and his, I would say, and this is a compliment to him, it's not like his effectiveness has been impacted by that. It didn't look like he took a step back last year changing systems. If anything, he looks more comfortable and like more knowledgeable. I think that's just because he understands. What is it that makes Russell special?
Obviously, you got to point out his ability to extend plays. That's great. And I think this year, more than most, he's not looking to run the football. He's maneuvering within the pocket. A lot of guys, when things collapse, things break down, they get out of there and they're just going to pick up 5 to 6 yards. I think Russell Wilson does a great job maneuvering within the pocket. And then it's just his long balls are great. His anticipation, again, anticipation. When you're a quarterback, you cannot throw to where guys are. You got to throw to where they're going to be. And I think Russell does a great job of doing that. I'd like to see him get better in the quick game. I'd like to see Schottenheimer call more just 1, 2, 3, boom, let it go. A lot of the Seahawks offense isn't based on that. It's a lot of play action, rolling out, get to the sideline type stuff. But Russell does a great job of, again, anticipating throws. And it seems like he's checked out of a couple plays as well this year to put him in better position. And then maneuvering within the pocket and keeping his eyes downfield. Now, I want you to sit back and have 400 300-pounders trying to rip your head off and see if you have the composure to maneuver through the pocket and keep your eyes down the field. I think Russell Wilson does a great job of that.
That's the hardest thing. I mean, how many quarterbacks actually have that ability? And how many quarterbacks have that ability and actually can make the plays in that spot? Because there are some quarterbacks that I think are maybe too calm under pressure. And you're like, all right, dude, step up into the pocket, make a throw. Oh, you're sacked. That's not good.
Watching Seattle's offense these past, I've started to get a little bit worried about the pass protection because I felt that it's never been great. That's never been a strength of Seattle, and I think that has to do with how their offense is built. He's been under pressure too much, though. And there's been a couple times where people have criticized him before for not stepping up in the pocket. There were two times where he stepped up in the pocket and he came right into a pass rusher. And it looked like, you never know for sure, it looked like it was Upati failing to pick up a guy that was looping around the edge. They need to provide him better pass protection than we've seen these past few weeks.
Yeah, I agree. I think this offense, when they're scouting their offensive linemen, I don't think they're looking for great pass protectors. I think they're looking for great run blockers. I think they're looking for physical guys, guys who can get to the second level, guys who will double team a 1 or a 3 tech. So it's all about the personnel that they have out there. You look at an Andrew Luck offensive line when he was playing. He had the best offensive line in the game at one point, and I think they got the right guys in front of him to protect him because they know they're going to ask him to throw the ball 35 to 40 times, where in this offense, you want some guys who are nasty, who are going to take on nose guards, get to the second level and get linebackers. So there's a give and a take there, you know? So because of the way this offense is built, I think the linemen reflect that. You don't have great pass blockers, but it's shown you're going to need those guys to pass block, especially when you're down.
It is Danny and Gallant here. We got Michael Bumpus in through 9 o'clock. We still have that code word to give away this hour, so keep listening for that. It's possible that an 11-win NFC team is not going to miss the playoffs, while the winner of the toxic waste dump that is the NFC East is going to host a playoff game. How is that fair? Well, we're going to try to explain next on Danny and Gallant.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios
on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Former NFL wide receiver Michael Bumpus hanging out with us as well. It is very possible that we could have a 7-win team, gasp, maybe even a 6-win team in the playoffs coming out of the NFC East, because it looks like the Dallas Cowboys and Philadelphia Eagles are trying to lose every single game the rest of the way. And look, I'm someone who does enjoy a little bit of anarchy, and I am someone who does enjoy ironically liking things like Nicolas Cage movies or Creed, the band, not the movie series. But I think it would be very embarrassing if a sub-500 team made it into the playoffs for our league. It's just a weird look. Oh, there's a 7-9 team in the playoffs, and I know it's happened before, and I know it worked out very well for the Seahawks in the past. I want to get rid of it. I don't know how you guys feel about it, but, oh, man, the Eagles or Cowboys making the playoffs? Gross.
I get where you're coming from. in the Northwest, no one here should ever complain about it because the Hawks did get in with a 7-9 record and
no
beat
beast
the Saints, and there's
that.
A beast quake, and that's a big part of this team's history.
That was terrible, wasn't it? That was awful. Like, that was just a national tragedy that we got to see one of the best runs ever in NFL history. Thank God we can avoid that happening again in the future.
Yeah, I mean, but I also get it as well. You celebrate division championships, unless you're the Patriots, because they win the division every single year. But there are banners being hung in facilities because of division championships. And if that's the law of the land, then that's the law of the land. And I'm okay with it because I don't think it happens often. When's the last time it happened? Were the Hawks the last team to make it in with a sub-500 record?
Yes, last, and they've been the only other than – oh, no, I'm sorry. The Panthers, I believe, were 7-8-1. In 2014. I believe the Panthers had a losing record, 7-8-1 in 2014. And they won their first round playoff game, too. So if you have a losing record in the first round and make it into the first round of the playoffs, you're going to win. You tend to win, probably because you're playing at home.
Yeah, I'm okay with it. It doesn't happen often, and that just means your division isn't very good. You know, that means you're competing with three other teams in your division who aren't getting it done. So I don't think it happens too often. Now, if this was every year there was a team I was getting in, with a sub-500 record, then I'd have an issue with it. But at this point, it is what it is. Doesn't happen often. Cowboys and Eagles, figure it out, and they'll be all right.
How would you fix it? And that's my biggest question. I don't think it's particularly fair. I also think that the solution that you could come up to it, you might end up punishing a team that's in a good division, because if a team that's in a good division and happens to win it at 9-7 because there's three other really good teams, they probably won't have as good an overall record as a team that plays in a division full of patsies. Like, oh, I don't know, maybe the New England Patriots, who perennially win a division that's awful and terrible. Like, you get an advantage by that. And I don't want to dilute a team's advantage for winning a tough division because they don't get to pad their record against patsies.
Isn't there a way that you can combine the thing that the NFL has currently, which is 8-4 team divisions? And I think there's a part of me that yearns for the days where there were 5 team divisions. I just think 4 is too few. I think there's only 4 divisional teams, and there's 6 divisional games that each team plays over the course of a season. It just doesn't really feel like it means as much as it maybe used to. So I was thinking, how about you combine 2 divisions per conference into essentially mini conferences, where you would get guaranteed home and home games with the original division teams that you have, so that you maintain rivalries. You get 2 games that alternate location year to year over 4 years against the rest of the division. So that's the other 4. So that makes up half of your schedule. You have 4 games against the other division. It's random, alternating location. So you would play each team in each stadium over the course of 4 years in the other 8-team division. And then you get 4 out-of-conference games. That's 16 games. The 2 division winners get byes. After that, the remaining 4 teams, the 4 teams with the best records afterwards, they make the playoffs. So theoretically, you could have 2 division winners, and 1 division could have 4 teams actually end up making it if they have the best win-loss record.
Yeah, that sounds good. That sounds like a lot too, Paul. You really thought about this one.
I did.
I appreciate that. But I'm a traditional type guy. I'm okay with the 4-team division. I mean, it seemed to work out. The only time we're talking about making changes is when you get a sub-500 team in.
This is embarrassing looking, though.
It just doesn't happen often. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Now, if we were in a different market and we weren't covering the Seattle Seahawks, then our argument would hold a little more weight. But the Hawks have benefited from this.
Yeah.
You know, so it's hard to say, let's get rid of something that the Hawks benefited from. And then one of the greatest plays of all time, we got to see it because a 7-9 team got into the playoffs.
Right, and we got to see it, and now we've seen it. It's not going to happen again here,
sure,
right?
Sure, it might. Yeah, it might. It absolutely might.
Another beast quake for a 7-9 team.
Here's the other thing. Other than just the magnificence of Beast Quake and the fact that we should, as just principle, fight for the retention of the system that allowed that to happen, here's the other thing. It's good for America to know that stuff isn't fair. It's good for America to know that things just aren't fair, because we've created a nation full of whiny babies who want everything sorted out, and as soon as something doesn't go their way, there is this tendency to first cry and then litigate. And what you need to be able to say to people when they say, like, it's not fair, you're like, yeah, you're right, kind of stinks. Yeah, get used to it. Like it or lump it, pal. Like, none of this. The idea that we need to make everything fair and perfect, like, that's kind of what's wrong with this country, is that we've stopped being able to just, okay, that stinks. I'm going to make sure that that doesn't happen again. It's like, no, I need to fix the rules. You need to fix the way the pass interference is reviewed. It's not fair.
You know, you actually hit home with something here, and you've now convinced me to abandon this idea to change things. While it is embarrassing that a sub-500 team can make the playoffs, I thought it was more embarrassing that the NFL bent the knee to the New Orleans Saints, who cried their little hearts out about that pass interference call, which was not the reason that they lost to the Los Angeles Rams in the NFC Championship game. The reason was that they couldn't take advantage of little Jared Goff and his headset not working so that Sean McVay can't mind morph into Goff's brain and actually make him look competent out there. And then, also, Breeze threw an interception the first play of overtime. And on the other side of things, the Kansas City Chiefs said, oh, it's not fair. The overtime rules, man, we should have been able to get the ball too. It's like,
yeah, it's not fair.
You can't change the rules every single year because it's unfair. So you've convinced me, Danny. I don't know about you, Bump.
Yeah, no, I like the it's not fair. I'm all for every kid does not get a trophy. I'm all for everyone doesn't get a sticker. You don't win. Deal with it. It is what it is. But as going back to the Rams deal, I mean, that was just a human error. Like, you should just find the referee that didn't make the call that happened right in front of him. Like, you should start.
There should be consequences for the referee.
You should start finding these referees. Like that play last week with the Patriots,
where
N'Keal Harris obviously got his knees up, got into the end zone line. Let's start finding these referees instead of changing rules like the Tom Brady rules. So now you can't dive at quarterback's legs anymore because you don't want great old Tom Brady to get hurt anymore. Let's switch it up and hold other people accountable. I'm all for the everyone does not get a sticker.
I used to believe that the best way to treat, like, when a coach screws up the instant replay challenge and, like, throws a flag when it's just dumb, that he should be forced to eat the flag. Maybe we should have officials who blow calls. Like, you have to swallow your whistle. Like, actually swallow your whistle. Like, that's going to be the punishment for you there. I would also like to point out that in the year since the New Orleans Saints and their fans spent the entire time crying about it, they are continually getting jobbed by the officials.
Good.
Including Sunday's game, where it was that fake punt where the defensive back, the jammer that ran down, like, held him the entire way. And, like, there was no chance for him to get the ball. And then they're like, sorry, on a fake punt, you can't get pass interference. Like, that's not allowed to be called. But it was like, yeah, he mugged him down. There. Like, yeah, but you threw it to a guy you by rule, can't interfere with him. You can't commit pass interference. It was absolutely awesome.
I really love the people of New Orleans because they're very fun people. But I really enjoy seeing them get so worked up at referees, and also seeing Sean Payton's face turn beet red whenever the refs are doing something. It's like a nice little side comedy that you get in every single NFL game that involves them. It's Danny and Gallant, Danny O'Neill, former NFL wide receiver Michael Bumpus, hanging out with us. Have you ever had a preconceived notion of someone based off of the way that they look, based off of the way that they sound? Well, one very prominent sports program had a feeling like that, and they missed out on what perhaps one of the most priceless things going on in sports right now. You'll hear what that is next.
Hey, Danny and Gallant.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios
on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Every superhero needs a weakness. Superman had to be kryptonite, right? If it's just Superman, it's not fair. Shaquille O'Neal, he couldn't shoot free throws. It wouldn't have been fair if Shaq would have been a 90% free throw shooter. It just would have been entirely unfair. And in college football, the most prestigious institution, like most storied West Coast institution, has its own stupidity. There's no other way to explain why USC does not have Ed Orgeron coaching its team and instead has something named, what's his name, Clay Travis? No, that guy's a commentator.
Clay Helton. He's a Clay very Helton. Nice guy.
Yeah, he's extremely nice, and he's a guarantee that you are going to be very, very mediocre. We bring this up because there's been some conversation, and actually Bruce Feldman, who has written a book with Coach Mike Gleach and is as plugged into college football as there is. He's actually the sideline reporter on Brock Heward's Fox crew, said that here's why USC ended up going against and not picking Ed Orgeron.
I think he can relate to just about anybody. You see, I mean, the governor of Louisiana was waiting outside the locker room. You can, like, he's very street smart, and I think that's one of the things that made him a really good recruiter is I think he can read people very well. I don't think Pat Hayden, who was the decision maker at the time, that's just not the kind of guy he wanted, and I just don't think he could get past it.
He couldn't get past it. Now, this is not when they hired Helton. My memory is correct. They passed over Orgeron, who has made the interim, and then they went and hired Sarkisian, which all in the end worked out really well for the University of Washington. But here was Feldman on what USC didn't see in Orgeron.
I think there were five or six guys who were old USC guys who were on that staff. And I spent a bunch of time around Marcus Allen, who's their USC great. Orgeron and he became close. He spoke to the team last week before Texas A&M game. Marcus was there on the sideline. John Robinson, legendary coach who was at USC, is now part of their program. And I think you see so many guys who understand what Orgeron is way better than Pat Hayden ever did. And that's why USC is where USC is right now. And LSU is the number one seed going in the playoff.
Bob, why didn't they hire Orgeron?
Because they are not very smart. Now, when I was being recruited in high school, I actually committed to USC for a little bit, verbally committed to USC, and Coach O was a big reason why. Because he had an energy, he had a presence. Now, I had to ask him a couple of times, huh? After he said a couple things, you know. I'm not going to lie about that. It's hard to understand him at times, but you feel the passion coming from him. You know that he cares about football. You know that he cares about football players, but that's just bougie L.A., man. You know, they want a certain type of guy. They want a Matthew McConaughey-type coach leading the way. And if they feel like he cannot stand in front of a camera or in front of the press and articulate the way that they see fit, They're not gonna pick him up, which I think is ridiculous because Coach O is a great coach and even better person.
I didn't know that you had these interactions with Coach O back in the day. What was your meeting Coach Ed Orgeron experience? Were you surprised by his voice?
Definitely. My first meeting with him, I went to a Nike camp that was at USC, and my buddy and I, Jason Williams, who ended up playing at Oregon, were being recruited by USC. So he comes up to us. And he's walking towards us. I know who he is, but I've never heard him talk. And he comes out and he's, Bubba. Exactly. That's exactly what it sounded like. And we look at each other. We're like, what did he just say right now? You know, and we're asking him to repeat himself. But once you kind of lock in and kind of read his lips and figure out what he's saying, you get used to the sound, then you're good. But it was great, man. I loved Coach. We went to my USC trip. We went to a restaurant, and before I talked to Pete Carroll to let him know I was gonna come in, I went to Coach. Oh, I said, "Hey, Coach, I want to play football here, and you're a big reason why."
Is there something about finding a way to show on the outside a almost fatherly presence? Because there's something about Ed Orgeron that just feels so trustworthy. I don't know what it is.
John Embry, another great young man from Destrehan, Louisiana. Hold on a second.
Hey, guys. Hey, I'm having a press conference, okay? Thank you.
Great young man. On a scrimmage, we wanted to get bigger. I'm stopping.
Hey, stop the ball, stop the drill. I'm having a press conference. Thank you.
We have to fix the line of scrimmage. Went all the way to Michigan.
That's so perfect because he does come off just like a dad there. Did you get that vibe from him? It's just he's trustworthy, or was there something else?
Back then, he was more like an uncle. You know, that was, what, 15, 16 years ago, you know, and it felt like you could trust him. It felt like he would shoot you straight. He wouldn't lie to you. As the kids say today, he kept it 100, you know, and and you can appreciate that, especially when you're 18, 19 years old. You're looking for guidance. You're looking for discipline, and it felt like he would discipline you and still love you up at the same time.
It is amazing to me that the desire for cookie cutter, sort of this guy fits our mold, gets in the way of people seeing. It's impossible to watch Ed Orgeron at LSU and the way he relates to his players, the way he's on the sideline, and not feel that that's just a perfect fit. And that if you got lucky enough to see that it would work. Yet I can also fully see how he doesn't quite fit, as you put it, Bump, with Bougie LA. Here was Bruce Feldman kind of saying that ultimately they really just couldn't get around some of the things he wanted.
I think what you have is a guy who's continued to evolve. He made a huge jump from when he was at Ole Miss to USC. I think he's made a significant jump after that. But I really think it's a USC issue. You have a lot of people at USC, especially back in that Pat Hayden regime, who couldn't get past what Ed Orgeron sounded like. They didn't listen to the players. They didn't listen to the staff. I think at the end of the day, you had guys who were... Ed Orgeron's not a country club guy.
And that's how you end up.
He's not a country club guy. And maybe Clay Helton is.
Look, I'm sure Clay Helton's a really nice guy, but I would much rather have the pig...
Not me, Samurai Jack, as my head coach. Not me. Give me Clay Helton. Like, that's what gives us a shot. The other part that's funny is, and this
that's a Husky, okay.
Like, yeah, USC, certainly their institution has a really strong pedigree. It has not been good. Oh, since the mid-80s, going back to the mid-80s, Pete's the only one that's got that thing humming.
It really is something. I mean, my entire lifetime, they have been good only with Pete Carroll. My entire life, like from age zero, 1989, to now... Just with Pete.
And could you imagine?
Coach Carroll, man, love him. He's a great inspiration in all our lives. Everybody that ever coached with him, he was an inspiration and a leader for us, and we appreciate him.
Could you imagine what he could have done in the recruiting process? He could go down south and get these guys. And if you want a good football team, you need the West Coast and you need down south, and you sprinkle everybody else in there. I think they missed out with Coach. Oh, he would have taken USC back to that Pete Carroll level.
Oh, man. Imagine USC with guys from down south. That is a scary, scary idea. With all the defensive linemen that you can find in Georgia and Alabama and all the fast guys in Florida. Wow. Yeah, definitely the Pac-12 dodged a bullet on that front.
If you're interested at all in Ed Orgeron, Bruce's book, Bruce Feldman, who works at Fox Sports, his book, Meat Market, is totally worthwhile because it is Ed Orgeron kind of back, and he's younger and fueled on Red Bull and even just as tough to understand. You can't read that book and not just feel an incredible amount of that Orgeron's just an endearing character. Really fun. I think I'm probably rooting for LSU in the college football playoff.
I am as well.
Because I am. Yeah, that, and I hope that Ohio State doesn't win.
That too.
Bump! It's awesome to have you here. We've had a blast having you in, and we look forward to catching up with you later this week.
Appreciate you. Good to see you, Danny. All right, Paul, holla at you.
Thanks, Bump.
All right. It is Danny and Gallant. We do have that code word to give away. 710sports.com/win. Enter the code word RUSH. You do that by the end of our show at 10 a.m. today. You'll be entered to win 2 tickets to see the Seahawks host the Cardinals. That's December 22nd. Plus, you're going to get 2 sideline passes. Remember, this contest ends when our show ends. We'll be giving away more Seahawks tickets tomorrow. Details and rules, 710sports.com/win. We're going to take a look at Seattle's offense and exactly what they need to do to get going, and whether this defense, is it really worth reinvesting in? We'll talk about all that's on the line coming ahead next.